Welcome to Season 4, Episode 17 of the Practical 365 Podcast with me, Steve Goodman, and Paul Robichaud. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Hey, Steve, I'm just here waiting for the sun to disappear because, of course, today is the day of the giant eclipse or rapture or apocalypse, depending on how you think of it. So to give us a little added safety today, we brought a special guest who is out of the eclipse area.
Yeah. I think I'm in the eclipse area. So is it not quite as far as you, Michelle?
I have no idea. I haven't been keeping track of the trajectory of the... No.
Oh, my gosh. I'm disappointed. I mean, anyway, I think just in case I've got my sunglasses. Oh, actually, no, it's the opposite, isn't it? I don't need sunglasses. That's and you're not supposed to look at it either.
Unless, you are not.
Unless you're the man in charge, of course. Oh, the memories. Don't worry, you'll get another 4 years of that. Very simple.
Half of the subscribers now.
We're off to a flying start.
Yeah, indeed we are.
A total eclipse of the sun is apparently here. If you're listening to this podcast, then this has already happened, and it's something way, way, way back in the past, earlier in the week, because we recorded this on Monday. And we're here with some fantastic news. And, of course, Michelle, who we last had on a podcast together when we were doing the UC Architects. Michelle DeRoy, my fellow Microsoft MVP. And I think we're the same vintage, aren't we?
The hair gives it away, I think.
for those at home, Michelle is also going a bit grey on the chin and very bold on the head. But Michelle, you've been an MVP as long as I have. We both became an MVP about the same time, didn't we? Or literally at the same time, me, you, and maybe Paul Cunningham. Yeah.
My first year was 2013 or something, and been an MVP ever since. So.
Maybe I've been 1 year older than you. But if it makes you feel any better, the day that I got my award, I was introduced to a customer as an MPV by a salesperson. But yeah, so you've been writing for Practical 365 for a while as well, and we'll be talking about your PowerShell professional series a bit later in the show.
Okay.
Now, Paul, there's a plethora of Teams news this week to cover, and
it seems like there always is. The Teams team is always up to something.
Well, they were up at Enterprise Connect 2024 a week ago. Talking about all the new features that they've got. And we talked about, I think, one of them that was on the roadmap, the voice isolation, 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
In the last show. It's supposed to be rolling out, but it's not rolled out yet because in a workshop on Friday that I was in, somebody had a crying baby with them for most of the day, which, to be fair, is absolutely fine with me because it means if my kids start screaming too, then I'm not going to feel embarrassed. But that sort of thing will be thing of the past. And as the chap I was talking to said, well, I wish it could do the same for my ears as well at his end. hold on a second though. You do need to hear the baby. So babies... everything from Benjamin Button style old people that are growing young to young people growing old will be blocked out unless they're you when you're in receipt of this new feature.
It's interesting because we as an IT industry are steadily focused on sort of filtering at the far end of the pipe. What I mean by that is voice isolation is great because it screens stuff out of your outgoing audio stream. Where your listener very well may be using some kind of noise cancellation mechanism to screen out noise where they are. But we do relatively little to eliminate the source of the noise in the first place. Right. So if you think about, and I'm not talking about babies. I'm talking about the trend toward open plan offices as one example. The trend of people to think that it's a good idea to take meetings from crowded airport terminals or buses or trains. There's a parallel there to spam. Right.
Yeah.
We all sort of collectively decided that filtering spam out after it had been sent was okay, instead of trying to stop it at the source by, I don't know, drone strikes on spammers or something. So I'm not really sure how I feel about that. The voice isolation feature does work well, though. I'm glad to see it coming to Teams because many of us can't control the environment we're in, or can't control the you know, the background noise that we're exposed to, but we can certainly keep from passing that on to the other folks on our meetings.
Yeah, I think it would be like a somewhat ironic, but probably almost like a truism that there will definitely be offices where two people are sitting next to each other. They're both at desks in a meeting, and they're using noise cancelling headphones, and they're using the noise cancelling feature to talk to each other in the meeting because they're in a meeting of 10.
Right.
And they'll need the noise cancelling headphones as well, because it can be a bit disconcerting when you hear the person talking and then a half a second later come out through the speakers as well.
Yes.
With your headphones. So, I mean, it is kind of like weird to think that some people have been dragged back into the office. They didn't make the meeting rooms hybrid and all that sort of stuff. So people are sort of having to rely on features like this to get rid of the crowded background noise. And then the other people on their meetings are probably sticking some headphones on to work in silence, or to work without all the background noise around them as well, because they can't get any peace. So most of the people in those situations, often they've been told that they've got to go in. So it's, although dealing with the problem and letting people work where's best for them would be one idea, it's not something that we're in control of, is it?
I'm afraid not. Although I'll add that to my campaign platform is drone strikes on the executive office of any employer that needlessly forces employees to return to office when there's no good reason for it.
I do actually wish there was an Outlook feature that got rid of emails that feel like spam, but they're somewhat unsolicited. They're unsolicited commercial email where they're written, and they're written and sent out sometimes by these AI or MailChimp, and they're personalized to you, and they keep on following them up saying, this might be the last time I email you. We should get on a call about this new product, you know, the Quest On Demand Plus 10. Quest don't do this, to be fair, but I don't want to mention another vendor. But they're, you know, selling some rubbish, right? And it's cold calling via email, really, repeatedly. And that's annoying. If you could get a good filter for all of that stuff so it just never came through, then maybe they'd stop sending it.
So, I mean, one thing that you can do, and I've seen other people do this, is just block the domain of any organization that sends mail like that to you. The problem is there's always some new startup that wants to spam you and say, hey, do you have time to connect to talk about XYZ? And if you block 1,000 of them, there will still be another one or two or 100 or 1,000 waiting in the wings. So it's a tough problem to solve. Maybe I could get a copilot for incoming email that would scan my email and automatically junk anything that it thinks I wouldn't be interested in. That's what Clutter was supposed to do for us, right?
Clutter, yeah. But that would be the most, that would be such an inefficient use of a large language model, though. Because, yeah, that was supposed to be, Clutter was supposed to be like a machine learned inference engine. So it would run right quite quickly against the contents of your email, but it never really.
I don't think you need to use a large language model. I think one of the emerging crop of small language models could probably do a good enough job to be better than what we have today.
Yeah. I'd like that autopilot for my email.
Maybe we could get that, and hear me out here, maybe we could get that as a feature in the new Outlook that will replace the new Outlook.
New Outlook reimagined in Win32 forms.
I love it. By the way, that's not a product announcement. We're not violating NDA by talking about this thing that doesn't exist. Just, you know, it could happen.
Well, anything could happen. In all seriousness, there are startups trying to reimagine corporate email. And,
oh, sure.
You know, Microsoft have almost caused to their own success. I mean, three Exchange MVPs are on a call right now, or former Exchange MVPs, Microsoft 365 MVPs. So we're part of the problem, right? So this isn't a criticism of Microsoft, but Exchange and then Exchange Online has become so popular that I see these and I think they're nice, but there's not any way that they'll really get off the ground. What large organization is going to move just their email to get those sort of AI features against their inbox, where it deals with problems automatically and does all these clever things? we're almost reaching out for solutions to email, and only Microsoft can really sort of fulfill them comprehensively, which is an unfortunate place to be, I suppose.
I think it is. And I guess we'll see their appetite for investing in that, as opposed to investing in other iterations of things with Copilot in the name.
I'm gonna skip ahead, though, past the Teams stuff, and then we'll come back to Teams in a minute, because it's a good segue to what, by the time it was posted, could have been an April Fool, but I don't think it is, which is, if you've ever wanted to use Exchange Online to send lots of uncommercial, unsolicited commercial email, then this is the feature for you. Actually, I don't think it is for unsolicited email, but people have been asking since day zero to be able to spam people with Exchange Online, or, as they like to think, send completely valid marketing and customer communications. And high-volume email for Exchange Online is coming into public preview, where certain accounts will be able to super blast out email.
Michelle, you spend a lot of time talking about sort of the nuts and bolts behind transport and how email moves through the system and whatnot. What do you think about this high volume feature set? Who's it for? Is it good for anything?
I can only imagine it was made up for a certain customers that, for example, have HR systems or salary systems that send out individual mails that get somehow require more control over those mails and the numbers of mails sent without hitting the limits of Exchange Online services. Then again, it's also putting, in my opinion, some extra work on the customers, because they need to address a sort of pool of addresses which are going to send out mail. Those addresses need to have accounts and licenses. So, yeah. And this is only for internal mail. So I'm pretty sure maybe there are also changes coming for other types of bulk email in the system.
Need to send more than one email to every single user per day that have over 100,000 people from one account. Because I've had customers who, and they've said, you know, Microsoft has said even their biggest customers have been denied rate limit increases, but they'll have been sending like a customer that is something similar to Ticketmaster, sending out that they used Exchange to do it, or the customers that keep things relaying from Exchange or use a third party solution to do this. And we've been arguing the point that this isn't needed for so long. Then how many customers are left that haven't had, that need this solved, that haven't found any other solution? And are small enough for it to matter to not run another email system or mail relay service, and are also large enough to need to send this volume of internal messages.
Well, and also, there's a cost component to this too, isn't there?
Well, why would you pay for it? We're already paying for the email system.
That's kind of my point.
It's right? Like when they wanted to charge for archive.
If I needed to do this from scratch today as a greenfield, then sure. It's great that it's already integrated with authentication and message tracking and all the other goodness that's already in Exchange Online. That's wonderful. So if I needed to suddenly start sending hundreds of thousands of internal messages, maybe this would make sense. And the cost associated with that is, okay, I get why Microsoft is doing it. They're not doing it because it actually costs them much more money to do this. They're doing it sort of as a bit of drag to keep people from misusing the feature, which seems reasonable, right? But if I've already spent money to put a system in place, why would I spend money to tear it out and then spend more money to switch over to using Microsoft system? I'm not clear on the value prop there.
They should be doing more to reduce the volume of email. Improving features. Imagine trying to sell this as a solution on its own to a business. You know, we've got this high volume email solution for your internal only email. It would have such a limited number of potential, you know, a potential addressable market that no one would probably go and develop something.
I just want you to join me in this mental picture. I'm having this picture of every time someone says, we need to send a large amount of internal email, that Jeff Teeper materializes and says, no, put it in SharePoint and everyone can see it when they want to. And then someone from the Teams product group comes in and starts trying to punch Jeff and say, no, those should be Teams notifications. Right? I mean, there's sort of this three-corner battle between how do you communicate to the mass of your employees, and there are three different solutions for it that each have their place.
You make a perfectly great solution, a perfectly great point, which is that SharePoint did receive some features that would insert messages into the mailbox that would also be for news communications, that the views of which would also count towards the tracking of page views in SharePoint Online. So they solved it almost a better way that made other people happy. And if customers have got another intranet solution, it isn't Microsoft's problem to solve, frankly, either. Isn't it always the case that there's always too many solutions for Microsoft for achieving the same thing, which leaves customers in a quandary of there's three ways to do this, which is the best way?
That's the cheapest way, usually.
High volume email. If this is the feature you've been waiting for, please do let us know. And, you know, if there's a really good reason for this, that because obviously we can think of a few for a small number of customers. But if there's a general reason why, let's say you work for an MSP and all your customers will need this, or half of them will need this, then let us know, because that'd be really, you know, useful insight.
Yes.
Now, should we go back to Teams?
Let's.
Yes. So we've got lots more features in Teams announced at Enterprise Connect. There's some new Copilot features that are on the way as well. But IntelliFrame, it slowly seems to be getting announcements, but very slowly is getting made available. And IntelliFrame is a feature that's exactly the same as the suggestion that I had on Practical 365, where Microsoft rebranded intelligent cameras as something vendors did rather than something they were going to do. Because I said, well, if they can do this for together mode, why don't they do this as a feature for framing people? So right. Automatic camera switching and all these sort of things. These features, though, I think are just taking far, far too long to come out, where Microsoft announced something and then they get sidetracked by, I don't know, Copilot, and put all their resources over there. And then general useful features that the masses can have been taking quite a long time to come. But it's kind of useful, because if you've got two cameras in a meeting room, automatically switching to the active speaker could be useful. Depends on the kind of meeting room, like an event room. If somebody in the audience puts their hand up and it automatically switches to them, that could be good. But also if they're sitting in the audience, they're going, I can't believe this. It's a bit boring, isn't it? And it automatically switches to them and focuses in like, vroom. That would be bad.
I mean, it's interesting to me to see at the MVP summit where Microsoft was broadcasting sessions to the MVP audience who couldn't be there in person. For most of the sessions, there was a human camera operator. So draw your own conclusions from that. I know that this manifestation of IntelliFrame is still fairly new, but usually Microsoft is very much, if you know, you can't even say they're on the cutting edge, they're sort of ahead of the cutting edge of deploying these technologies for their own internal use. And I'm planning on taking my lead for IntelliFrame's utility and deployment from seeing how does Microsoft and Avanade are kind of the two places where I would expect to see this broadly deployed first.
And Accenture as well. I remember we had them on a little while ago on the podcast, and they're really on the cutting edge of stuff. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you can use all the features there, because we know as MVPs that when you're using beta features, sometimes they don't work quite as expected. So, you know, the jury's out for me on that.
I mean, there are a lot of cases like that. I'm actually thinking of Security Copilot when I say that, because I saw a thread this morning from Joe Stocker on Twitter, which I still refuse to call X. Take that, Elon. And he ran a poll. It was super interesting. He said, if you provision a single security compute unit, which I wrote about a couple weeks ago for Practical 365, if you provision one SCU, that should be $4 per SCU. He said, if you keep that SCU for a month, what would you expect to be charged? And the two choices were $4 or $2,880, which is $4 per SCU times the number of hours in a 30-day month. Hmm. It looks like right now, and Rod Trent of Microsoft has said that Microsoft is working on clarifying their official position or their official explanation. It looks like right now, if you provision one SCU and you use it one time at the beginning of the month and you forget to delete the underlying Azure objects, you're going to get a $2,880 bill at the end of the month, which I don't think is broadly expected among the population of people that are eager to try Security Copilot.
You almost guided into trying it as well through the various portals. I've seen it pop up. That's expensive for what it is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I mean this is what Microsoft wants. You know, there's a pie. It's there for everybody to take a piece. Microsoft would like a big piece of them. They are a big company, and they do a lot of good stuff. So that's why they're, you know, early movers there. If they, the good side of them charging a lot of money for this stuff, though, is it leaves room in the market for competitors. So it creates the conditions for a healthy market by putting a premium on that stuff, I suppose, is one spin on it. But that's expensive.
That's a good point, right? I mean, if a single compute unit costs $3,000 per month, ballpark, the real question to be weighed is, do you get more than $3,000 per month of value from using it? And I don't know. I don't think anybody can know yet, because this is such a new product. And despite the case studies and the, you know, sort of Microsoft propaganda around this, I don't think we have anywhere near enough real world data to know if that's true. Boy, you heard all the complaining from people who said, wow, $30 per user per month for Copilot. We'll never realize that value.
Who said that, though? I know Tony did say something.
I was trying not to call out anybody in particular, but yeah, Tony said it.
I disagree with that.
$3,000 a month, I mean, for that, that's starting to approach the lower bound of a part-time security human to analyze this stuff, right? And I don't know. We'll have to wait and see how Microsoft meant for the cost to work. It seems like, given that the security compute units don't do anything unless and until you're querying them, it seems reasonable that they ought to be priced on demand in some way. And maybe Microsoft thinks they are, because you don't have to provision any SCUs until you want to use them. But I think they're going to have a hard time selling it at $3,000 as the floor price if it's meant to work the way that it does today.
Well, I suppose it depends. Is it replacing people? When you're talking that sort of numbers, then it's got to remove the need for a new job to be added to the team, or it's got to remove people from the organization. Is that where Microsoft are going? And
right,
as we were talking, do you think they use Security Copilot themselves? And if so, do they have an internal transfer cost to pay? Because that'd be interesting to know. Because we do say, yeah, you know, sometimes it's in beta and all that sort of stuff. But Microsoft, I don't know why they always think that their product is so bad they'd call it dog food. Because who wants to eat dog food is my first question. And if that should mean that, if, you know, if they're doing this, then people like Satya Nadella, yeah, execs at Microsoft, they should just wipe out PAs entirely from the organization. If it is cutting costs, if they're planning another round of layoffs, every role that could be replaced by Copilot, every role that Security Copilot, live the dream. You know, don't have camera operators at Ignite. Don't have translators sitting in the back actually translating at Ignite. Use your software and let it fail so people can see how well it works. If it breaks, that's fine. Everyone won't feel like it's a glossy demo of the future. And then it makes, when you're talking about the future stuff, far more exciting in a way, because the new stuff that's here, we actually get to see actually happening. But I doubt they do that, because people are people, aren't they? They won't get rid of PAs. And this is stuff to sell. You know, I'm sure Microsoft will be using Security Copilot though themselves, won't they? In some way.
Oh, no question.
But not at that price. Because if you're making it, why would you charge yourself that money? so that's, I don't know enough about it to say whether it is good value or not though. So I suppose time will tell. It's been GA for a couple of weeks now.
No, it went GA April 1st, so it's been GA for exactly a week.
So there's going to be, as you say, customers who've been using it in preview. All these customers will be telling great stories about how they have gained a lot of success with it.
You know, there's something about Security Copilot that I think people need to be mindful of. I first heard this phrase from the legendary Casey Lempson, who I had the good fortune to run into at the MVP Summit, where she's leading the user experience team for Copilot for Excel. And she said, in Excel, 99% right is 100% wrong.
Yeah.
When it comes to Copilot. If Copilot is going to give you a wrong answer 1% of the time, that's really bad in the applications for which Excel is used. I think that's true for Security Copilot.
It is.
Right?
And don't forget, we had Jonathan, I think, on the podcast a few weeks ago, who was saying you have to think about these Copilots a different way. You know, that people expect a computer to be right, but this might not be. But, yeah, you can't. It's not a maths machine. That's what you got a calculator for. With Excel.
Right.
With Excel, we got calculators and accountants got those. And then they got these computers, microcomputers, that had this great automation stuff. And that's what Excel is, right? So that now it needs a copilot as well. Isn't Excel the copilot for maths? Isn't their job done?
For calculation, sure. Not for inference or not for...
But you don't...
You're not for some of the other things that LLM-powered systems can do. But if you ask for summarization, for example, if I take a set of data in Excel and I ask Copilot to summarize it, the way summarization works now for Teams and Word and Outlook, I mean, I love that as a feature. But if you ask Outlook, if you ask Copilot for Outlook to summarize a mail thread three times, you're not going to get the same answer all three times. I don't think that's okay in Excel. If you say, hey, Excel, highlight the 10 highest or 10 lowest values,
you sort of expect that to always be consistent. Excel is built to do already. It's built to do those things. I get that I don't know how to use all the features in it, and it can help me use the features. But I'm just not sure whether it needs to be helping you do maths, because that's what Excel's for in the first place.
I mean, in fairness, it's not GA yet, and Microsoft hasn't publicly listed all the things that they're adding to it between the preview and GA.
Yep.
So, it's probably a little premature on that front. But going back to Security Copilot, if I'm going to ask it to summarize, for example, and tell me all the risky sign-in events that are associated with Michelle's account, I sure hope it didn't miss any, and I sure hope if I ask it three times, I get the same answer each time. Mm-hmm.
Or the other thing you have with Copilot, and you tell it it's wrong, and it's saying, oh, you were right, I was wrong, this is the answer. That also happens a lot.
But yeah. But not everything needs to be a chat, does it, when a Copilot is helping? Sometimes sometimes there are things that you shouldn't be giving it your opinion on to help it. I don't agree with the salary results. They should be higher. Oh, I'll just recalculate that for you. Yep, everybody did get a pay rise. Even the math says no. But there's examples on Reddit a lot where different LLMs, including like the Bing style, but Copilot in Windows or Edge, ChatGPT and others, are confidently going like, no, 5 and 5 is 11. Didn't you go to school? No, it's not. It's 10. You say back to it, it's definitely 11. And it's like, what's going on here? Is it just basing it off an argument that people had on 4chan 10 years ago that was supposed to be funny? I don't know. But that the context of that worries me a little bit, as it could confidently declare, even with the right instructions, you'd have to have another LLM to check it. You'd have to have a different engine to check what's going on. And if you've heard about these AI detectors and so on that have been causing kids at college and uni no end of problems, just because they write in a boring, generic way, like they've been taught, they're getting picked up as AI. Right. Or they get their, your English essay is completely right. You must have used AI. It's so bad that I get my kids to put track changes on. So at least you can see what they've done to create that. But if it can't detect that stuff so well, and these are doing such a bad job, then I think you'd be well advised to really test out what Copilot for Security is going to be doing.
Also an area, if I may interrupt, in which precision is of importance is, for example, the GitHub Copilot, or you ask Copilot to give me some code to perform some function. Nowadays, it's a lot better, but especially Copilot sometimes gave, if you ask, give me PowerShell code, for example, for a function to do this, then it sometimes spits out code which is not PowerShell, or it has errors, or I wouldn't give money to the people who we copy and paste that one-on-one and think that's the proper working solution for them. But
It's exactly the same as if you give somebody who doesn't know how to do maths a calculator. If you can't remember how to, which order you do things in, but you know enough to do it twice in that calculator, and you'll know it when you see it, then it's the same with GitHub Copilot, I suppose, isn't it? Where you can ask it to do something and it gets it wrong. And you know it's wrong because you use it to save time or save time to look something up that you remember. Like I used it the other day. I use it all the time when I'm coding. In PowerShell, I always forget how to create a new object. So I use it via comments. So I just bought create an object that has that I'm going to use to store these three variables. So it just does it. That was fine. It's simple. And it saved me looking it up.
Yep.
Do you use it for anything more than that?
Copilot, no. But the GitHub Copilot can be a quick time saver. But like you said, you can save some time. But on the other hand, you have to check if what it produced is exactly the routine you wanted or the call you wanted. So you gain some time, you lose some with checking. But in the end, it's more like a super autocomplete, and especially if you type in the comments more or less what you want, then you have already the frame to start with, and then you make your edits. And
I always love it when you ask it to create the comments at the top for you, and it adds in some person's name as the author. What the hell?
Copyright, no?
Okay. But it is the same as a normal Copilot, though. And that's the thing, using it to generate a first draft that you then might work from, generate a paragraph that then you might rewrite in your differently, or to get the juices flowing. It's not a bad thing. I think if you haven't used GitHub Copilot and you do PowerShell, then you definitely should try it, because it's a good way of accelerating what you do. But I suppose before some people even try it, then there's already fears from programmers that their jobs will be eaten by AI already.
Well, because I'm old, I vividly remember there was a gentleman named Ed Yordan, who was one of the early researchers into trying to figure out what made one programmer more productive than another, along with Tom DeMarco and Barry Bohm, and people who studied the history of software engineering will recognize some of these names. But Yordan wrote a book in the late 80s called The Decline and Fall of the American Programmer. And it was all about how automated systems were going to completely erase the need to have humans write software. And he was doing this against the background of the Japanese government-funded fourth-generation AI project, is what it was called. And he genuinely believed that, oh my God, in just a few years, machines will be self-programming and there won't be any need for programmers to do anything. And looking at the quality of what GitHub puts out, it's a great way to get started. But I think if you took 100 pieces of code that had been written with the assistance of GitHub and gave them to Michelle and said, Michelle, I want you to take one example of a bad thing from each of these submissions and write a column about professional PowerShell based on not doing that thing, you would never run out of material. I don't know. I guess I'm not afraid of being automated out of existence just yet.
No. Max, I've spent so much time making this story that developers king as well. Surely there is an open source project for automated development that Microsoft have got, as well as, you know, some commercial companies doing this, but I completely agree. if anything, it's just a different way of doing things, isn't it? The programmer will focus on the really complex, innovative stuff, maybe in the future, in much the same way that people use libraries instead of writing everything from scratch. You know, like go back 10 years, maybe 10, 15 years, people would write authentication libraries for every web application themselves, pretty much. And they build their own authentication systems. And now they theoretically shouldn't need to, because they can take it off the shelf. It'll be more secure than they could ever make it. So it's a similar sort of...
I'm smirking. You know, our readers or our listeners can't see that, but I got this big stupid smile on my face as soon as Steve said these libraries would be more secure in light of what happened with XZTools.
Oh,
maybe they'll be more secure. Or on the other hand, maybe your AI assistant will be hacked by NSA or GCHQ or somebody to insert a backdoor that, because you're not as good a programmer as the AI, you'll never catch. I mean, who even knows, right?
Oh my God. Well, it sounded like a bad American TV show now. Which is almost like I think there was an episode of one of these TV shows where the bad AI did do that, and it inserted itself into every computer via an antivirus software in the world, so it could then help rise up against the good AI. Oh, dear.
It's funny you say that, but it's a real thing. So Ken Thompson, who is one of the gentlemen who brought Unix into the world at AT&T, gave a lecture when he won the Turing Award called Reflections on Trusting Trust. And this is, you know, legendary in computer science circles. And he was, I think, the first person to, you know, point out to a popular audience, you could write a compiler that would take source code in and emit a compiled binary where the compiler added a backdoor. That would be trivial to do, and it would be difficult to detect. It would be easier to detect today with a lot of the tools we have, except that it would also be harder to detect because our knowledge of how to write a hard-to-detect backdoor has gotten better. So it's not a new problem, and it's not a theoretical problem. You know, we see these kinds of attacks being mounted. AI co-programming tools don't do it yet, but it's probably just a matter of time. That'll be fun to watch.
Yeah. Fun times ahead. So, I mean, let's get back to programming and properly introduce Michelle DeRoy, Microsoft MVP, to talk about. I would say that practical PowerShell. If you're writing PowerShell code these days, then you are in a way a developer. Not quite the way that some people like Microsoft sometimes mean everyone's a developer, and they mean low code and stuff like that. But it's not like scripting, really, is it? In that some things you write in PowerShell pretty much are as complicated as C# or Python code.
Yes and no. The skill set is more or less the same. You need to decompose, work on the structure, what you're trying to accomplish. But the challenges are more or less the same. You need to organize your code. Also, let's talk a bit about why this series on Practical C65 was started, because especially after sessions, encountered a lot of administrators who had questions on how to make the transfer from using those one-liners they find on the internet or they have in their OneNote, copy-paste them, to developing their own script or make small scripts which consist of more than one line.
So is that a case of pasting it in and moving the cursor and hitting enter, tab, enter, up, down, tab, tab, and then save? That's literally what I've done on occasion. This would be a good script. I can't leave it like that as one line, though, in the file.
But it's also an accident waiting to happen, potentially.
That's what my wife says about me in general.
I'm sitting sort of between the world of infrastructure and the world of developers, because Microsoft is pushing DevOps. A lot of, I would like to call it ops dev, because I'm approaching it from the other end. But it's the administrative type of people who still loves their GUI and wants to do everything in a graphical interface for some reason. Who is not very eager to learn PowerShell or at least develop something of their own. And then there's the developer who has a lot of scripting knowledge, knows how PowerShell works, maybe some also more theoretically how to use PowerShell and what's the best way to solve things, but I have less knowledge of the products and the workloads themselves, so sitting more or less in between. So yeah, I'm trying to cover that that gap with this series, to giving them some basically practical tips, and guidance in that area. I'm trying to stay clear of all the semi-religious, this code, this formatting works better than the other thing, because that's more of the PowerShell people discussion.
So where do you sit on what's a controversial topic, which is like when I open PowerShell, it keeps on saying install the latest PowerShell for new features and improvements, and I'm not going to. So I've just changed my Microsoft Terminal profile to do PowerShell hyphen no logo, so it stops bugging me. Should I write a few scripts a week maybe? Should I be upgrading to a new version of PowerShell? I want my stuff to work anywhere, though, without needing some newfangled PowerShell.
Only if you want the latest and greatest, Steve. But you know that probably also from experience that installing the latest and greatest is also introducing the latest and greatest bugs and things that don't work anymore, new versions of PowerShell. And you're probably very familiar with all the modules which were... were being deprecated end of last month. The Azure AD module, the MS Align module. Microsoft is pushing hard on moving those people over to start using the PowerShell Graph SDK. That had a deadline of September somewhere, where they were stopped being usable, and that was being extended, probably due to some proper feedback. But those modules on themselves can also be quite a hassle to organize them, to manage them, to update them. Then they have conflicts, modules stop working. Then you have the mess when you use PowerShell 5 modules in PowerShell 7, which do not always work, or you need to use a compatibility mode, which disables some of the PowerShell 7 functionality you might want to use. So it's a struggle, to say it nicely.
So, I mean, is your argument really that people should avoid these modules, use the Graph API, and just use invoke web request?
I've seen people use the real underlying web requests also after doing the necessary authentication calls to avoid this module hodgepodge challenges.
Or just use curl and be done with it. And then you've got cross-platform compatibility for your scripts as well. You can just throw it.
The downside to that is that if they change something on the back end in your call,
yes,
then you also need to accommodate for those. So then you would be more safer to go with the module work. But then
that was what I thought you were going to answer with.
You want to have to cut off your left arm or your right arm, a choice.
Well, that's the thing. If they changed that, that was the point that I thought you were going to make back to me, actually, that well, you end up with the same problem, don't you? If they change the API, yeah, then that's why they changed the module.
Yep.
But that's an important thing, maintaining those modules and so on. But I was interested to know then, what if you're a PowerShell scripter, then you mentioned GitHub Copilot earlier, and do you think for somebody who's writing a couple of PowerShell scripts a week that it's a worthwhile investment?
To be honest, yes. Especially if you're starting scripts, can easily put out, if you make a few comments on what you're trying to achieve, puts out the whole template for you. If it's the script itself, it's a function, then it looks up if somebody already did the work for you, then it copies that. It's not always the thing you're trying to achieve, but you might give it a few tries or interact with GitHub and ask it what you want, and then usually it comes up with something usable from which you can start working.
I guess you talked about turning that one liner into a proper script. if you've got the code there that does it and you want to make it better, give it more juice, convert the aliases into the right thing, then that's a good way of using it, isn't it? To not just refactor it, but take this one liner, add the right tests, because it can add the try, catch, and so on, parameterize it, and all those bits that you didn't want to, that you could do, but you didn't
also need to. For newcomers, for people not so savvy in PowerShell, what is also very useful is you can throw code at it and ask it. For example, if somebody has a weird line of formatting their code and it makes a big one-liner, putting semicolons between everything, you can ask Copilot give an explanation what the code does. And then it gives you a line by line. This line does that, then does that. Insert Copilot disclaimer here. So I might be wrong.
You can get it to explain the code as well. So generate well-commented code. Because if you're describing what you want to do first, and then
that's
you
the
hit
point
enter,
of commenting.
You look like you actually commented your code, but actually you were getting it. Unless then you've got five comments that all said the same thing several times, and it didn't do what you wanted. So you've got to know a bit though. If you're good at one-liners, then you're going to find it useful, because clearly you know if you hit the one-liner that is going off and deleting stuff recursively and, like, you know, changes down directories, finds and delete things, then moves back up and down. Dangerous scripts like that. If you run things like that as a one-liner, which you probably shouldn't do, I should add, then you'll probably be safer in the hands of GitHub Copilot than you are today to get it to analyze it for problems. Could this escape out of the directory tree that I'm navigating?
Well, that's what everybody's being told that uses code found on the internet, of course. It's to review the code that you're trying to execute in your environment. If you're using Copilot for that purpose, fine with me. Might even be recommended if you're not that skilled or being lazy.
I was stopping speaking to give Paul a chance because I know I'd been jumping in.
No, I was happy. I was completely happy with Michelle's explanation there.
Do you remember when we did the UC Architects and that would happen quite a lot?
Yeah.
And it was like there was...
Good luck to the editor.
Yes. Oh, dear. It does happen. It happens far less with us, usually on the podcast. So let's get back to where we were. So in the second part of the series, you were talking about taking some of these scripts, making functions out of them as well. I always think it's really great to have a bunch of my favourite functions that I always use for stuff. I've got one for like changing the desktop wallpaper, for example, or for removing ghost devices from my home PC. And I always just have them in my PowerShell profile as functions I can run anywhere. Do you do that sort of stuff? Is that the sort of thing you recommend? Or is it also just when you're building scripts that turn into functions and then you turn into modules?
Yeah, the profile is also something, especially people coming from the Linux, Unix world should know about the existence of those files. But in PowerShell, I have something similar. You can load functions which you use a lot or you want to use a lot to make them always available in your session. That can be a big time saver. Then again, if you use those functions to create a script which you're going to publish externally, that's of course something which you don't want to do unless you include also the helper functions you are referring to. But then comes the point of when you turn something that useful into something for the public, maybe you want to convert it to a module and then publish it in something like the PowerShell gallery to make them available for everybody to use.
Now I've got a question, because you mentioned as a Unix, so I'll probably spend more time at home on that side of the fence. Because I write Bash scripts a lot, and I also write PowerShell scripts, and I prefer the object-oriented methods, you know, most of the time. But it depends on what I'm working on. And I finally started looking at that Oh My Posh thing, because I like my I like my Bash Steve at Megatron, and I wanted to have Steve at Galvatron when I'm on my Windows PC. because that's what I named my computers. And I looked at this Oh My Posh thing, and I hate it. It doesn't seem like anything a Linux admin would like. It just seems overly bleh. And that's something you have to stick in your PowerShell profile to load up every time you log in. Just for, and it has terrible colorization, and it takes up double the space. Am I wrong, or do you love it?
I think it's up to personal preference. Yeah, I use it.
Do you use it? I bought it, and I thought, this is purely for someone who wants to look like they're special if someone walks past their screen. Like, oh, he must be clever, or she must be clever. She's got like a massive, fancy prompt. I just wanted something simple.
It depends. If you're also working a lot with GitHub and you're in a PowerShell prompt, you can have it show what the current status is of your script. If you need to still put push some things to the GitHub repo, for example. So I'm not putting in some fancy colorized rainbow. It's more functional.
Okay. Related. Oh, so you see. Well, there you go. Now you've convinced me, because the amount of times that I'm in a folder and I'd like to know whether there's a newer version that I could pull of a project or my code or whatever, it can tell you, can get it to tell you that.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
And if you search for
I need one for Linux.
Yeah, I flip the whole time also between VS Code and the prompt itself. And yeah, I'm not popping over to see if I need to pull something new. So,
you know, I am surprised, actually. I didn't realize that your first answer back would be something that means that now, any time that I'm like in a folder, I'm like, have I got the latest version? And then I'll just blindly git pull off my, which I probably shouldn't do. I'm going to have to use it, aren't I?
You should try it,
Look
Steve.
At that. That's 180 degrees to turn around. So if you want to be convinced of more PowerShell tips and tricks and why Michelle, well, he does know what he's doing. He's always known what he's doing since we met over, 14 years ago now. He's always been great at PowerShell scripting. So you should definitely read his articles. And look at that. You know, I've presented on PowerShell. I moan about some newfangled stuff. And straight away, he's in there with an answer. So he's better than me, that's for sure. Would you like to help out with a project for a GUI for an Exchange admin thing?
Is that a repository been dead for a few?
I've got other repositories that are active. As soon as you mention the IT administrator that likes a GUI and doesn't like to use PowerShell, I was like, oh gosh, I know there's a few people listening who think that.
The CPU manager can use an update, Steve. Come on.
It could do, yeah. I'm still getting around to installing Exchange Service. Give me time. I've got to untar my domain controller.
I think you have the same problem as me. As soon as you publish script, you become the support department of the scripts, and that fills your emails quite easily.
I don't become the support department. As the people who've commented clearly know. But yes, Tony reminds me of it on a regular basis. I'm not going to promise anything though now. But yes, you do some fantastic work. And again, listeners, if you've been listening to Michelle and thinking that you could do a good job at writing some PowerShell scripts, then please feel free to finish that script for me, and your own as well. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, long-term listeners will remember you from the UC Architects. Oh, what fun we had. With Serkan coming in from Bermuda back in the day. Well, I had a good time anyway, even if you've got no comment whatsoever on it.
No.
I see we had listeners' feedback that flows in one direction.
Remember, we had listeners' feedback then that it was starting to get annoying that every episode it was a guy, it's great weather here and I'm on the beach.
It was Tony Redmond. Tony Redmond is one of the people that emailed it.
I wasn't
say,
calling him out.
No, quite rightly. Emailed in to say, that exact point. It's lovely and everything, but we don't need to hear about how great it is for Serkan in Bermuda, in having a lovely time on the beach in every show for 10 minutes. Oh, dear. Some things never change, though. But actually, he doesn't live there anymore. So long-term listeners need not worry that Serkan is enjoying himself on a beach. I think he lives in Ireland now, actually. So Tony Redmond...
Yeah, he's in Ireland.
That's where... Yeah, I last went to see him a few years back. And what was he doing? PowerShell. Loads of great PowerShell scripting. He wrote a bot, basically, in PowerShell, interfacing with Teams. Even those that get to live on a lovely island in the Caribbean or thereabouts end up stuck in a cold, rainy country writing PowerShell. So if that's what you're doing this week, then that sounds like heaven. I'm going to edit so much of this.
Yeah.
Someone talk whenever I stop. It's harder with three of us. Because we're not sure who's got us. It was hard with 10.
Oh, God.
Because we'd all stop talking for ages waiting for the next person to speak. And it would literally seem like tumbleweed. So that is, I think, all we've got time for on today's show. Am I right, Paul?
That is it, Steve. We'll be back, of course, with more special guests. I don't know if we've announced our next guest, but kind of a big one.
Oh, yes. Alex Weinert will be on the show. So don't forget to listen to that show. That will be absolutely fantastic. And we will see you in 2 weeks' time. So don't forget, you can listen and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and where you might be listening to it now, the practical365.com website. So that's all from me and Paul. Until next time.
Yep. Thanks again, Michelle. Bye, Steve.